Thanks for tuning in here to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Won't you take a trip with me now, 25 years into the past? 1991. Remember what that sounded like?
Got a smile so bright, you know you could have been a candle. I'm holding you so tight, you know you could have been. Don't tell me it's not worth trying for. You can't tell me it's not worth dying for. Call you every night and give you flowers too.
Thanks, Naughty by Nature. And Bryan Adams was in there. UB40, CNC Music Factory, Color Me Bad. Maybe you can see why some music critics at the time were saying rock and roll had died. But then this happened. September 1991, and Nirvana's album Nevermind comes out. Unexpected, massive hit. Seattle suddenly known as the epicenter of grunge. Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot co-host a public radio show, Sound Opinions, and Jim DeRogatis started out telling me pop music was bad before Nirvana broke through, but rock and roll was not dead in 1991.
I mean, the cliched shorthand is that, you know, Nirvana came along, kicked Michael Jackson off the top of the charts, you know, and bands like Poison, the hair metal bands. You know, that is a reductive shorthand history that is has very little to do with history. You know, the fact is that for a decade or more after the initial punk explosion in England and in New York in the mid-70s, there was a vibrant and thriving American underground.
Yeah, I think the Pacific Northwest scene in particular, you know, had a lot of great bands in the 80s that we knew all about and would come out and see them when they would tour. You know, Wipers and Green River and Fastbacks and Melvins. These were great bands, and they just didn't happen to be charting. But rock was alive and very well, including in the Pacific Northwest. It was, to me, more a matter of time. I had a brother-in-law. I still have a brother-in-law who would send me cassette tapes back in the day when cassette tapes were the coin of the realm, filled with the new sounds from Seattle. And I remember hearing bands like Mudhoney and Nirvana in their infancy because of that, and thinking, man, this is great stuff. Nobody could predict that this was one day going to be commercially acclaimed music as well as cult status music, but it happened in a matter of years. And I think, as Jim said, the groundwork had been laid going all the way back to bands like the Ramones and the Clash and the Sex Pistols in the 70s, and I think it was in a lot of ways a culmination of all of that.
We remember the Nirvana album Nevermind as touching off the Seattle explosion. Why do you think Nirvana struck such a nerve with youth culture at that time?
Well, Generation X, demographically speaking, people born between, 62 or 64, the sociologists said it at, and the early 80s, are one of the smallest generations of American teens in history, sandwiched between this massive baby boom and the baby boom's offspring, the millennials. And it was a generation without an identity, a generation that felt it had been lied to. We grew up eating our Fruit Loops while having our cartoons interrupted on Saturday morning by the Watergate hearings. We're cynical and jaded. You know, all that slacker stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Richard Linklater's Slacker and Cameron Crowe's Singles filmed in Seattle, right? There's an element of truth there. We weren't going to be bought and sold, or we were going to fight it. And out comes this sound from largely from Seattle, but the rest of America as well, that is real, that is raw, that is authentic, and we connect to it. Now, I remember sitting with Kurt Cobain and Chris Novoselic and saying, boys, I don't understand. When I bought, Touch Me, I'm Sick by Mudhoney, as the single on Sub Pop, right? I thought this was the song that was going to change the world. We'll be right back. you know, why wasn't that song Smells Like Teen Spirit? And they both said to me, honestly, we don't know why Smells Like Teen Spirit was Smells Like Teen Spirit. You know, Mudhoney should have gotten there first, or Kurt would say the Melvins, although he would say that with a smirk because he knew you had to be a little bit more than a little bit twisted to love the Melvins.
How did big music, how did the major record labels react to the success of the Seattle scene, et cetera?
They were sharks at a feeding frenzy. You know, you're talking about a major label industry that no longer exists anymore, and that to anybody under the age of 30, I think, is they can't even believe that it ever happened that way. If you've been watching HBO's Vinyl, you know, that this kind of big corporate mentality ever existed in rock and roll. You know, but they descended en masse with their Platinum Amex cards, taking any musician busking on the street in Seattle out to a $300 dinner and signing them to a recording contract that they would, you know, get this allegedly big advance, but they'd have to pay it all back. You know, the whole thing lasted 2 years. And by 1993, 94, Billboard ran a front page article. Greg and I had an interesting perspective on this because we had been to Seattle. We were both writing about the bands in Seattle. And then 2 years later, Billboard said, the new capital of cool in America, Chicago.
Yeah, you know, the industry is famous for co-opting good ideas, and then once it's co-opted, the idea doesn't become so good anymore. It becomes sort of a sellout notion. And I remember being in Seattle, you know, when Cameron Crowe was filming Singles, and the cynicism, the level of cynicism was just hilarious. I could compile a comedy album based on the response I was getting from various musicians and club owners and record store, owners in Seattle at the time all of this was going on. They knew it was a passing phase. And at the same time, you've got all these bands that didn't have a prayer of getting played on the radio, commercial radio, completely ignored, for years, even though they were great bands. Bands like the Butthole Surfers, the Jesus Lizard, the Melvins, getting signed to these major label deals. That, to me, was one of the most amazing aspects of this. And then they all got dropped. Two or three albums later, they're off the label.
Yeah, you know, if they're lucky, they got a new station wagon out of it. And right. That's about it, you know?
Right, but all this industry, it can't be said enough that in the early 90s, this entire alternative industry developed around, what had been an underground scene for most of the 80s. This scene had been around for years. Lollapalooza, the traveling festival, the movie Singles by Cameron Crowe, the emergence of what became known as the alternative rock radio format. I mean, these kind of things couldn't have been imagined in 1988. And they all came true by 91, 92, 93. And as soon as we started to see this commercial tinge put on the whole thing, that's when it lost all its glow, all its innovation, and it was time to end it.
Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot from Sound Opinions, you guys often will pick a Desert Island Jukebox songs. You can't live without them. So what's a song from the Seattle scene you want to throw in that jukebox, Jim?
Oh, I'm going to go with a Mudhoney song. Like I said, Superfuzz Big Muff comes out. I bought it, you know, at Pier Platters in Hoboken, New Jersey, on vinyl, Sub Pop record. I just love that record. I just loved it. And I think the song If I Think, right? Again, I think a lot of this has to do with pronouns. With Kurt, it was here we are now, entertain us, you know. With Mudhoney, it was If I Think, I Think of You. And it was, you know, the humor in that song. First of all, one of the greatest guitar riffs in history, right? And then the humor of saying, you know, if I think, and I'm not saying I do all the time, but on those rare occasions when I think of you. It's a brilliant lyric. It's a brilliant vocal. It's an incredible guitar riff. And it's got that, you know, it's got that Nirvana formula. You know, the soft, sweet, loud, hard, you know, fast, slow. It's a perfect song.
How about you, Greg?
Well, Mudhoney is a great choice. I love that band. Another band that I loved from Seattle during that era was Screaming Trees. I thought, unbelievable band. And to this day, I still stand by most of their records. Nearly Lost You to me is a great song. I just love that. I think it sort of gets the essence of that group, that little psychedelic, propulsive, those great Mark Lanegan baritone vocals. You know, to me, it's a timeless sound. It transcends any way, any tagline or, you know, oh, this is the grunge era. No, this is just a great rock band with a great rock song. And I think, you know, people 20 years from now will be discovering them and saying what a great band this was.
Is there a legacy of the Seattle music that we're talking about?
You know, Lester Bangs in the 70s did this famous three-chord history of rock and roll. It was his thesis that the three chords of La Bamba were the same three chords of Louie Louie, were the same three chords of No Fun by the Stooges, the same three chords of Blitzkrieg Bop by the Ramones, and today we could add the same three chords of Smells Like Teen Spirit. Each played more nasty each time, each hopefully using that second person plural. We're in this together. Let's make a mess. I want to say lots of curse words here, right? Let's get in trouble is what we're about to do. There's a certain attitude to rock and roll, and it's we don't like the status quo.
Jim DeRogatis and Craig Kott are the co-hosts of Sound Opinions, which is coming here to Seattle this Friday, a live show at the Neptune Theater with special guests, Mudhoney,